Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How's Florida?
It's warm.
Yeah,
you know, I bet. Florida is wont to be.
That's what I hear.
It's nice though. It's a nice change. It was kind of warm when I left Boston, but I think it's cooled down since I've been here.
Hmm. Still, that's so we should say you went to Star Wars Celebration. How was that?
I did go to Star Wars Celebration. It was pretty great. I got to do a lot of fun stuff, which was not waiting in lines, and then I got to do waiting in lines, which is less fun. But oftentimes there are fun things at the end of the lines that you wait in. So that could be quite cool. I got to see, you know, several panels, Mark Hamill. You got to see the Last Jedi trailer. So, you know, all in all, it was a successful weekend.
Waiting in line to see or do something cool is the truest sign ever that Star Wars is owned by Disney.
Well, and
in Orlando.
You know, it's going to be owned even more by, I mean, not owned even more, but it's going to be more and more a part of the Disney identity. I did go to the panel that they did about the future of the Disney theme parks.
Oh, boy.
And the Star Wars experience there, which sounds amazing, I got to say. And I'm someone who came, I feel like I came fairly late in life to theme parks. I'm not like a huge theme park goer.
Yeah.
I was noting, I have been to Disney World before, but it's been 25 years. So I'm guessing it might have changed a little bit.
I've never been to Orlando. In fact, but I am looking forward to trying out the Star Wars land in Anaheim at Disneyland when that opens, because that's, I remember being on a podcast like many years ago and wondering why. I think it was the one we did after Disney bought Lucasfilm and announced that there would be a new set of movies, and we all had that same thought of like, why is Tomorrowland not Star Wars Land? And the answer is because they're going to add Star Wars Land.
right. I had people complaining like, oh, I feel like Tomorrowland has been too, like it competes too much with the Star Wars stuff that's already in it. And the answer to that is, let's just build an entirely new experience built around Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant. Everything they showed off, and granted, it's still very early days, but there is something, you know, taken love or hate Disney. I think people have very strong feelings about it as a company and as a corporation, you know, that is feels like it's in basically its mission statement is monetizing joy. But I feel like to the credit of the people working there, they are genuinely excited to build these kinds of experiences. And seeing the team up there who is in, you know, sort of in charge of building the parks experience, which is a mix of Disney and Lucasfilm. Sort of in one team, hearing them talk about their love for Star Wars and their love for the parks experience is just, it's very convincing. Like, it's very easy to get swept up in that. And like, even though, you know, you kind of, sometimes it can feel like a capitalistic, you know, experience. The stuff they're describing is stuff that I want, like the experience of like being not just like riding rides within a Star Wars land, but like being immersed in the world of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like, that sounds incredible. I've wanted that since I was like a little kid, right? Like, you know, so why would I not want that, even if I'm gonna have to like shell out all my hard-earned money for it?
Yeah, they were talking about a Disney cruise-like experience, except instead of being on a cruise ship on the ocean, you will be in a hotel in Orlando attached to the Star Wars land of Disneyland or Walt Disney World. And the hotel itself is going to be styled as a Star Wars space liner.
Yeah,
basically.
And this is entirely separate from the existing what they talked about. Like, this is a totally, that's what kind of blew me away, is that survey has been going around, and from what I can tell, that is sort of part of the hotel experience, but distinct from the actual like parks experience.
Yeah, I think the idea is that you'd be let into the park at some, you know, edge times when nobody else is let in or something, but that you know, the core of this experience is, you know, you pay like $1,000 a person for this 2-day experience where you are on a Star Wars spaceship, essentially, and you can observe or participate in your meals. Most of your meals are covered as a part of it, like a cruise ship. And I mean, what's fascinating about this idea is that you are, it's taking all these other bits of Disney that they've done. It's like the cruise ship experience where it's all inclusive. You're in this space and it's completely decked out as Star Wars. So you can be as immersed as you want. You can participate in the story, or you can just kind of watch it unfold around you at dinner or whatever. It's, you know, that's, you're going to be able, Dan, here's something I predict. In the next decade, you are going to be able to walk into a cantina populated by aliens and order a drink.
I am looking forward to that immensely, but I'm looking forward even more to the thing that they discussed during that panel, which is the fact that you and your friends will be able to essentially take control and fly, not just watch someone else, but actually fly the Millennium Falcon through it, some sort of experience. And depending on how your experience goes, that will be like, it's almost like MMO style, like your reputation will then like affect your experiences in the rest of Star Wars land, which sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But also amazing. So
it'd be like, oh, look, it's that guy who crashed the spaceship.
Exactly. Well, they say, they kind of like made a suggestion that like someone, it was kind of implied like Chewie might not be very happy with you if you ding up his ship. I was like, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I love this idea so much. So yeah, I'm a convert is what I'm saying.
That's wild.
Wasn't going to take much.
No, that's true. That's true. And you'll pay for it. I mean, like physically, you'll pay for it with cash in the wallet.
I absolutely will. I will. I will be mortgaging everything I own.
Yeah, to live in Star Wars land.
But you know, for the moment, Star Wars Celebration is a pretty good substitute for that. You get to like, there's lots of people in cosplay, tons of stormtroopers, tons of droids. You know, people just sort of roaming the halls of the convention center. We don't get a lot of cosplay at Apple conventions. I feel like it's not a thing we do. So it's a little different. But yeah, I did. I missed out on the, if I'd slept overnight in the Last Jedi line, I could have gotten a visit from Rian Johnson.
But
because I only got there at 6 a.m.
Like a sucker.
We were not important enough. Yeah, exactly. Like a sucker.
Yeah, I'm never gonna sleep overnight in a line ever.
That was not my,
for anything.
I have done it. Yeah, ironically, the only thing I've done that for in my life was to get hockey tickets in college. For the season tickets for our hockey team, because that was kind of a big thing. So my friends and I got our sleeping bags and set up in line, managed to find a really long extension cord and plug it into an external power outlet and plug in my MacBook or my PowerBook of that era and a couple portable speakers and watch movies while we were lying in line, which in the year 2000 was actually pretty impressive. Nowadays, everyone be like, oh, you have your iPad. Like I was sitting around reading my phone, checking Twitter and stuff like that. But yeah. 18 years ago or so, that was not really a thing.
What else do we have going on? Anything? Not a lot. We've been posting a lot of links this last week. I mean, I was gone to Ireland, but
yeah,
I've done that elsewhere. I did the UK and Ireland thing. I've done it before. It's not that exciting. I mean, I enjoyed it, but what do I have to talk about? I feel like I've wrung so many stories out of that. I don't like listening to, here's the story I wrung out of it this time. I don't want to listen to AirPods on the plane because planes are noisy and AirPods are really bad/good at letting in outside noise. And there are a lot of times when that's great, like when I'm out in the world, but when I'm sitting on an airplane, I kind of don't want to hear the plane. So I now bring two sets of headphones with me wherever I go. I bring my trusty in-ear monitors with me, and I bring AirPods because there are lots of contexts where the AirPods are great. Like I was riding the train to go see our friend Anthony Johnston, who lives in the north of England, and I was riding the train, and so I could hear people kind of talking around me while also listening to stuff on my iPhone, which was great.
Yeah, I tend to travel with multiple headphones because I have the Bose noise canceling headphones, which are spying on me. And I have others. Usually I bring either a wired set of headphones. On this trip, I bought my lightweight Bluetooth headphones because of the run I'm doing.
There you go. So, yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. And I use the AirPods for everything. I had somebody ask about like compare these to a pair of wired Bluetooth headphones because I have the Jaybird Blue Buds. Which I bought because I was curious about Bluetooth headphones and their earbuds with a wire connecting them. Mm-hmm. And so this guy wrote to me and said, you know, how much of a difference does it make? And I said, I'll just put it to you this way. Since I received my AirPods, I have not used those once. I've not touched them. They're away somewhere. And I keep thinking I should just sell them or give them away or something, because I'm never going to use them, because I didn't like that little cord. And, you know, I could, it could bounce around under my chin, or I could put it behind my neck and it would kind of bounce around back there. And you have to kind of wrap it around. It's like, nope. The moment I got the AirPods, it was like, forget it. That's it. So I'm very happy with the AirPods. And I do them, yeah, walking the dog or running or whatever. They work great. Love them.
Yeah, I'm interested in the fact that they seem to be in still in very short supply.
Yeah, yeah.
They're hard to get.
People are like camping out, not quite overnight for a pair. That's not quite, but they're on the line.
And then Tim Cook walks down the line, gives you pizza.
Well, online, there's that is in stock website, mm-hmm, that lets you, it's like airpods.isinstock.com. That will actually, you put in like what store you want to stock and an email, and you'll get a notification saying, AirPods are in stock. And our friend Aline Sims just got a set, apparently, by that means, by stalking her local Apple store via is in stock.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's, it's interesting to me. I mean, I wonder if part of that is that the AirPods are so, I don't want to say so advanced, but like, because they're complex and new machine, like new equipment, that they haven't managed to produce them at scale, where they underestimated how many or how popular it was going to be. Because what throws that into contrast to me is that these reports we've seen this week on the next iPhone, and suggestions that the sort of flagship iPhone, for lack of a better term, will actually be on the, like, might arrive later. And I agree, when you're moving stuff in huge volumes, I'm sure that the supply chain challenges are likewise large. But this has always seemed to be Tim Cook's sort of sweet spot in terms of running the company, is that he's the man who, you know, makes everything work and or gets everything sort of on time and together.
Right.
And so I can't tell if it's just these things are so immensely popular that it's just still hard to wrap your, you know, organization around providing that scale of stuff, or whether they are, you know, slightly miscalculating things.
I got an email from somebody who said, why isn't anybody talking about how Apple is getting worse and worse at being able to fulfill demand for stuff, and that this is supposed to be what Tim Cook is good at? And on one level, I totally get that. On another level, first off, I think there's some rose-colored glasses going on there about Apple's history. There are lots of times that Apple has failed to fulfill. And back when Apple was really good at fulfilling, it was because they made too many. And one of the ways that Apple ekes out, because Tim Cook is not just good at supply chain management, he's good at efficiency. And one of the things that he made his name on was reducing the amount of stuff that was in inventory that they had made and hadn't sold yet. The downside of, and that is efficient, and it helps you make money because you're never making things, you're never buying parts, you're never doing anything that doesn't have a buyer for it, essentially. The downside of it is you can misgauge demand. It also means that depending on how you've worked it, you don't have a lot of margin for error, and if something crops up at any point, it can throw your whole supply chain out of whack. There are lots of downsides to it. And let's throw it in there. I mean, Apple has a huge demand and still makes products that are far more complex than most of the products that are made, including by their competition, because they do extra stuff. And I think the AirPods is a good example of that. I suspect the delays with the AirPods are more about, I mean, it's about solid demand, but it's also about the fact that I think they're really hard to make, and that the tolerances are very specific, and they probably have issues because it's such an ambitious product. I think that's my gut feeling, is that is what's really behind all of this, is that it's a hard problem. It's a hard product to make because they have, you know, look, you see this, all these rumors about the iPhone 7, right? Like you mentioned, or the iPhone 8, the iPhone whatever, mystery iPhone, future iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of those rumors, like the Bloomberg story that Mark Gurman wrote, you're seeing into Apple's product design thing, where they'll design something and say, this is awesome. And then they'll go to China and look in the factory and they'll talk to their suppliers and they'll be like, can we make this? And the answer comes back, no, we can't, you know, like,
we can't produce 85 million OLED edge to edge screens.
Well, the
in
screen,
that time frame.
They could get the screens, it turns out. But in the Gurman report, they were saying like they wanted this really curved back
glass. Yeah.
That was glass, and their glass manufacturer was like, we can't we can't do that. And so it's like back to the drawing board. And that's a give and take of product design, right? You can't, product design of a hard piece of hardware is not, it's the art of the possible, right? You can invent something that looks amazing and is impossible to build it other than like a one-off. And you, if that's all you can design, you failed as a product designer because you can't mass produce that. And that's, this isn't just art, it's commerce. You've got to make it. But I do see that push and pull with Apple a lot, where they're like, they want to push it. Apple makes its name being on the edge and doing things that other people aren't doing or can't do, or that very few companies can do, and trying to do all of this stuff. And it can lead to these production issues where, like, they're figuring out how to make stuff that is very hard to make. And I don't know. I mean, it comes back to like a almost like a marketing challenge, right? Which is, do you announce the product if you can't fulfill? And do you allow demand to build up because people are so excited about your new product? Or do you, in the case of Apple, everything's rumored anyway, so it's already building up. So do you admit that it's going to be there, or admit that it exists, but not ship it for a little while? Or do you just pretend it doesn't exist until you've got so many of them that you can start to fulfill? And I think there's no right answer to that. I think it's a judgment call, and that, you know, this new iPhone, if they announce it on the same day as the iPhone 7S and 7S Plus and say it's really not going to be able to ship until December, is that good or bad? I think it's probably what they have to do, right? Because not everybody's going to want to buy it once they see how much it costs and what the detail is. Right. And the last thing they want to do is to have nobody buy the new 7S or 7S Plus,
right?
Because they don't know what the 8 is going to be. So you announce it and you let it sit there, and it sucks, right? But I'm not sure there's a better option.
On the flip side, if you're the person who's going to want the top-end phone, no matter what it is or what it looks like, you're going to buy it anyways, no matter how late it shows up.
And you're going to order it and sit there and wait, and it'll show up when it's ready. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think that it mainly comes down to ambition, you know, sort of dealing with the practicalities, right? Like that intersection of idealism. Like, this in an ideal world, this is the device that we would build. And in this world, this is the ideal device that we can build, which is, there's a fine line between those things. But I do think it's interesting that they, just that their volumes, I think, are still so large too, that this is still a challenge in this day and age. But, you know, that's the price of being successful, I guess.
Yeah, this is part of being a wildly successful international company, right? Is that Apple can't design a product that they're only going to sell a few thousand of. They, like, literally can't. Everything they do, they have to design for mass production.
Well, maybe not a Mac Pro, but maybe. We'll see.
Well, okay. Fair point. Actually,
most things.
Talking about the Mac Pro, I think this is a good example where we all like to speculate about stuff, and sometimes it's our job to speculate about stuff involving Apple. I think this is a case where maybe, you know, you hate to say, I hate to assume that Apple is going to behave this way, because surely there is somebody at Apple who has thought of this, right? And, you know, in reality, I think it's more like, surely somebody at Apple made this argument and maybe they weren't listening to them or they didn't believe them. The Mac Pro is a good example of this, where I feel like it was clear to a lot of people, but whoever was making decisions at Apple didn't understand it or didn't want to believe it. And only recently, when they announced that they are going to do a Mac Pro again, did somebody seem to have woken up and been like, okay, I see why I should have listened to you guys before. Mac Pro is a really great reason where, like, they made the trash can. It was a mistake. I saw a great piece today. Let me see if I can find that. That was a great piece by Daniel Pasco from, I don't even know where he is now. I first met him when he was at Black Pixel, but it was Daniel Pasco is a developer, and he wrote this amazing story about it's on Medium. So if you search for it, you can probably find it, called Back to My Mac Pro. And basically, he went and bought a 2009 Mac Pro and put a new video card and an SSD in it. And it is way faster than basically any Mac you can get. And he switched to it from his 5K iMac. It's got 12 cores, right? It is an amazing computer for probably a couple thousand dollars that he put into it, all told. Mm. And the Mac Pro thing strikes me as being that Apple thinking that its approach to consumer technology could be applied to all markets, which is a bad idea, right? It's like on its face, you're like, no, some of your markets are not consumer markets, they're pro markets, and you can't treat pro markets like consumer markets. They behave differently and their needs are different. And whether it was, no, we're going to do this, or whether it was just easier to think of everything through the lens of the consumer market, this is one of those cases where the market kind of rebuked them, and somebody at Apple finally got the upper hand. We'll say Phil Schiller, but I mean, it literally could be anybody who gets the upper hand and says, no, we need to follow a different playbook. We need to make a really, you know, you can design a nice enclosure for it, but really we need to make a boring computer that has lots of slots, that is upgradable, that is like the one we made in 2009, and put it out there for people and update it on a regular basis. And, you know, that's that. So saying like everything that they build has to be for, you know, mass production is thinking that way. Like every Apple product is like this. And the answer is, except for the pro products, which aren't. You know, it's hard, right? You get in a mindset. I think so much of it is just like, this is the way we think as Apple now. We have to think about doing it this way. We have to follow this playbook. And this is a case where that was not, they learned or relearned that they couldn't do that.
Yeah, well, it isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. I mean, and the scale, economies of scale and the audience for an iPhone and a Mac Pro are incredibly different.
I'd argue that as a philosophy, it is applicable to more products than you'd think. But
it's more than it isn't. I would agree with that.
It's always good to think about, like, it's always good to at least approach it that way. Like, let's not approach it as we're going to make something boring. Let's try to think bigger and go beyond. But the problem is that if you get so caught up in that you are unable to stop yourself and say, I know we can make a touch screen remote control for the Apple TV, but maybe that's a bridge too far.
Right.
And if you fail to do that, you've maybe made a product that is trying to be edgy and has gone out beyond the edge of where the consumers are.
Essentially, it all boils down to Ian Malcolm saying, you spent so much time thinking about whether or not you could do this, you didn't stop to think about whether or not you should.
Yeah. That's, you know.
So there you go. There you go. It's the engineering lessons from Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I was going to say everything I learned from Jurassic Park. Clever girl. I learned that at one point.
What would Jeff Goldblum do?
Yeah. So Daniel Pascoe's story was really cool. The new Mac, it made me want to go out and buy a 2009 Mac Pro. But the point there is that, like, that's an 8-year-old computer and it is still incredibly powerful. And in reality, I mean, what Daniel says at the end is kind of ridiculous, because he says, Apple, just put this thing back in production. Like, yes, and it would be amazing if the cheese grater just came back. But my guess is they're going to do, maybe it'll even tip its cap to the cheese grater, but my guess is that they will do a new enclosure that'll probably be a little bit smaller, that is using modern, you know, more modern tech and has some amazing fan technology and things like that they'll get to promote, but that in the end is built like the Mac Pro and G5 enclosure was built around the idea that it is a high performance computer, and computers sort of have a shape and they do it for good reasons, and that you should just, you know, make it that shape. So I do think they'll do something like that. And I think that'll be great, because they lost their way. I mean, they lost their way and thought that they could apply those principles in a place that it turns out that they couldn't. Right. I would even argue that maybe on laptops, as much as people have pushed back about those Mac Pros that are the MacBook Pros, that on laptops in general, their principles are good. There are issues there, but in general, I think the principles have served them well, that a lot of the laptop decisions they made, while some people have complained, have probably been pleasing. I mean, the jury's still way out on the touch bar, but the Apple TV is one that comes up that comes to mind, but the Mac Pro is the most obvious one. It's just, sure, just let them have their computer. They don't care. They don't care that it's not, you know, beautiful and curvy. Although if they just come back with a cheese grater and in gold, people lose their minds.
Throw that right in their face.
They can take the optical drive bays out, though. They can do that. Take those right out.
Don't need those anymore.
Shave those off.
I only got one computer left that has one, so when that goes, I literally have to set all my CDs on fire.
I have two, actually, external
on fire.
External Blu-ray drives that I use for ripping when I need to, and otherwise they go away. On fire is fine, whatever.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Should be done. Microwave them.
Yeah.
Create plasma. Yeah, so, well, I guess we've solved a lot of problems.
Yep.
About macros and AirPods. Yeah, so let's see. What do we got coming up?
I don't know. We got to do another magazine because it's another month. Stupid months keep happening.
Yeah, keep going around. What a pain. Yeah, there's that. There's lots to look forward to, Jason. There is a Star Wars movie, as we discussed, coming out.
Yeah.
In December.
That's why I'm here.
Exciting. We sort of did a podcast about it, but not really.
Yeah, the Ian McKinnon, one of our incomparable listeners, edited together from other podcasts a fake podcast of us talking about the Star Wars teaser trailer, and it's you and me and John Siracusa all edited in, and it's amazing, especially that he found you say something about episode 9. That killed
me. I was listening to it and was like, wow, he must have, the fact that he spent all the time, it's not even the putting it together is really easy, it's finding the clips that work. Like, the amount of hours that I assume he had to go through to listen to these podcasts and find the right clips. Whew. Good on him. He can do all our shows from now on. Assemble the soundboard, put it all together.
Yeah.
No interference.
Amazing.
From us necessary.
Amazing.
So, well, I guess I won't podcast it anywhere about my thoughts about this trailer then, because we didn't do an incomparable show. So I'll keep them to myself.
You can share them now. I talked to Serenity about them on Upgrade. We can do it here in the secret podcast. No one needs to know.
You want to talk about Star Wars?
Okay.
I'm very excited. Well, so getting to see it in a big room full of Star Wars nerds is always a very different experience, rather than watching it on my phone later, in part because you can't hear everything. So you're like, I have to watch this later so I can understand what people are saying. But getting this sort of feedback from the audience is, you know, you get sort of swept up in that whole zeitgeist of it, which is a lot of fun. And for me, I think, you know, the biggest question for me going into episode 8 has always been, we saw how episode 7 kind of lightly retraced the lines, and in some places not so lightly, over episode 4. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Empire Strikes Back is the middle of the story, and as thus, it's got a very different shape of it than either A New Hope or Return of the Jedi. And so it's not necessarily, there isn't an easy way necessarily to do like the same thing that J.J. Abrams did with episode 7 in terms of like, let's kind of like borrow a lot of these elements from the plot, because it doesn't necessarily make sense. And so I'm sure there will be some similarities and some callbacks, but they certainly can't hew as closely to it. I don't think there will be any giant thing that they have to destroy that looks like a Death Star. Let's hope not. I mean, I think that was fine as the, you know,
it's the murder planet.
Yeah. Murder town, population U. And I just rewatched Rogue One the other night with my friends here. And one of the things that we found remarking was that we think, you know, thinking that, Rogue One in some ways does a better job of the set dressing, as it were. It feels a little more Star Wars-y in the part. I was thinking particularly, we were noting this as the parts where they're walking through Jedha early in the film, and there's like just weird people all around them. And it's not like the cantina or Maz's place, where it's like everything is crazy and new, and we're going to spend a lot of time sort of lingering on all these different crazy characters. It was just like presented very matter-of-factly, like, they're walking through the streets and there's just weird stuff around them, but we're not going to stop and like deal with the weird stuff. It just permeates everything. It's much more workmanlike in that way, which I think is kind of pleasant, rather than something like episode 7, which takes the sort of point of view of a person who is been isolated and has to come to a new world and thus like, you know, be astounded by every new thing they see. So, and that's, you know, there's different story construction methods going on here as well. But yeah, I don't know. I'm looking at the trailer and getting a chance to see some of the stills that they showed during the production, which will reassure you about things like, oh, good, it looks like Finn won't spend the entire movie in a hibernation chamber or whatever.
Right.
That's exciting. Lots of stuff that's on the trailer. There was that thing going around late last week or early this week that was the so-called comparison between the two trailers, which was
a lie.
In fact, yeah, which is a lie. But it is interesting to point out that the trailer, overall trailer cutting felt very much like that first teaser trailer.
Yeah.
Which is to say, lots of disjointed scenes, not a lot of dialogue, mostly voiceover.
So,
and I think that's intentional.
So what I think is the most interesting thing about the trailer is that it makes you wonder about like the Jedi and the Force and like things you've assumed about Star Wars for a long time. Because at the end of the trailer, Luke says, and again, I guess this is a spoiler, except I'm about to say that it's not, which is he says something like the Jedi must end or something like that. Right. It's one of the only things said by a person where you can actually see them talking in the whole trailer too. I have a theory that that is totally a misdirection and that that's at the very beginning of the movie where Rey shows up and she wants him to train her. And he's like just living his life as a hermit. He had all of his students, you know, go bad on him, which is where we got Kylo Ren. And he's gone to be a hermit on Jedi Island. And now she comes and says, no, you need to train me. And he's like, no, this is bad. The Jedi are bad. I don't want to do this anymore. Everybody has died. It's terrible. The Jedi have to end. So that's my theory, is that that's actually from very early in the film before she convinces him to train her.
Well, so it's like a pseudo, like, he's kind of like Obi-Wan, but he's taking the opposite tack of like, yeah, I'm still hiding out, but like, I'm not like looking for a new apprentice. I'm, in fact, quite the opposite.
Yeah, I just want this all to die down, and I'll die out, and the Jedi will die out with me, and the stupid universe is better off without him. Because, I mean, look, Luke's story, even though he doesn't speak in Force Awakens, the story is that he was training a new generation of Jedi, and it went very badly.
Right.
And they formed their own thing and went off, and Kylo Ren is working to restore the Empire. So they all basically got taken by the dark side, and Luke and people died, presumably, and it's very bad. And Luke is like over, and he left and disappeared, and nobody's seen him in years. So he's in a really dark place. So when Rey finally shows up, I don't think he's going to be like, oh, thank God, I can't get Cable out here. Right. I think he's going to be like, no, I don't want my lightsaber. I don't want to train you. I want you to go away. What do you mean? R2's here? Okay, you can leave R2, but take Chewbacca and get out of here. I think that's what he's going to do.
I suspect you're probably right. I think the sort of other more conspiracy theory-ish angle around it is this idea of, I mean, you look at what, you know, the way Lucas portrays the Jedi in the prequels is, and to a certain extent in the animated series, the way they're portrayed in Clone Wars, it's not very complimentary. The Jedi are kind of jerks,
yeah. Right?
Like, there's a lot of stuff they do that is, like, you could make the argument that essentially the Jedi Order is responsible for its own downfall because of the way that they treated Anakin and, like, the whole, like, you must not have your relationship or whatever, right? Like, they were very dogmatic. They're very, like, strict about these things, and eventually someone was going to rebel. Granted, it was a somewhat like damaged, you know, psychopathic murderer. So you could have picked that better. But, you know, I think there is an argument that, like, you know, the Jedi are not necessarily the shining examples
right.
that they're remembered to be in the original trilogy 4, 5, and 6. And so there is an argument that it's like maybe the whole idea of Jedi versus Sith is a bad idea, like, because that is what's causing, we're drawing these lines ourselves, and as a result, we are causing the conflict and the strife. Like, you know, not to say you can't have someone who uses the Force and fights with a lightsaber, but that may be the idea of adhering to those classical Jedi rules, which Luke himself didn't even really do because, you know, he was not well-trained.
Right.
That is a mistake, and instead, we need to find, you know, a sort of balance, but that might mean a person who is neither Jedi nor Sith.
Yeah, I think
that's where I'm going with that.
There's a line of dialogue in the voiceover that is Luke saying, what is it? Like, there's so much, it's so much more.
There's so much more, yeah.
And the idea is that if you simplify what he's learned as a monk is basically like, this whole Jedi versus Sith thing, man, and this goes back to what he says about the Jedi must end, the whole Jedi versus Sith thing, man, it's not the way the Force really wants us to work. We all have the Force inside us and something like that. But I really think, like, I like the idea that this may be where this series is going. Is like, undercutting everything, like the way that they did it with the Master and Apprentice for the Sith Lords, the way the Jedi had their whole big temple and were out in the universe like as peacekeepers and all that. It's like, that's not how the Force wants to be done.
That's not how the Force works.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, it's like, I mean, for me, it boiled down to, I was thinking about this the other night and was thinking, yeah, that some of the problematic elements of the Jedi Order really drill all the, like, the line that encapsulates them the best, which is actually from the prequels, is, I believe, Obi-Wan saying that only the Sith deal in absolutes. And it's like, you don't get what you are saying, and yet you have kind of summed up the problem by saying it.
Yeah. Yeah, I always, you know, as a kid, I always pictured the Jedi, and this is maybe something that I just hate about the prequels. Maybe that's it. That George Lucas's view of this when he came to build this was in opposition to how I had pictured it as a kid. I think that is one of the core things for most people with the prequels is, again, everybody's going to have their own vision, but it didn't match, and that's going to cause dissonance. Even if they were really good movies, which they weren't, it was going to cause dissonance. But as a kid, I always pictured the Jedi as being like cowboys. Like the gunslingers in The Dark Tower by Stephen King, right? That they're loners wandering around, righting wrongs, making sure the good wins, but that they're not like part of a, as so much is in the prequels, like a bureaucracy.
Or even like a religion so much.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's sort of like a difference where they have like this, you know, having a church versus having like itinerant monks.
I think
it's like
could
a,
be,
a very different
right.
feeling.
I think there could be a church, right? It could be like a religion, but it's the kind of religion where once you're ordained, you go somewhere and set up a thing, right? You don't, you're not part of, you're not like Roman Catholicism, right? But more like.
They're like Unitarians.
Yeah, exactly. Space Unitarians. We've solved this, Dan. We're done. We did it.
We've cracked it. Mm-hmm. We've cracked the story.
We nailed
finally.
It. Yeah.
Leave it all on the floor. Have you, are you a watcher of the, any of the animated stuff?
I, have been meaning to watch, the Clone Wars series and just haven't. And I have like two seasons of Rebels piled up on my DVR. That used to be our like dinner time entertainment. And then my kids have too much homework now. So basically I haven't seen Rebels since the middle of season two.
I will say that was the other fun stuff to see is that they've done a fascinating job of really filling in the cracks of a lot of the, like, sort of mortaring the bricks that are the movies with these. In Clone Wars is definitely worth watching, and Rebels is also really, really good. And as they go along, they start to connect those two more. And now that they also showed off, well, at one of the panels I was on, these shorts that they're doing starring the heroines of Star Wars. So Rey, Jin, Leia, Amidala, like, all this stuff, which is, seems really cool, too. And they're even having, like, Daisy Ridley and Felicity Jones voicing those characters, coming back and voicing those characters in animation, which is awesome. So I think that's a really, really cool move. But having the animation has really, I think, helped drill down into that. You know, Star Wars has never, there were talk for years of a Star Wars TV series, and it never materialized, like a live action one. But they were like in, at least, you know, got as far as doing pre-production stuff, I think, for it. But it never really got into development. And so, you know, the fact that animation often feels like a second-class citizen because it's not like, it is canon, but it's not like something that everybody pays attention to. But it's opened up a lot of possibilities for them to explore elements that you just don't have time to do in a movie. And so it's definitely, they're definitely both worth watching to see the way, like, you will, let me tell you, like, Clone Wars goes a long way towards redeeming a lot of where the prequels fail in terms of those characters, especially. And so, you know, you can kind of put those, like, it's weird coming back to the prequels after having watched, like, Clone Wars, and you're like, oh, wow, these were now, like, I've kind of accepted that they exist, but I forgot how bad they were. So, yeah, there's a, it's, they're worth watching to sort of flesh out the universe a bit, if, and they're fun. So, throw that out there. It was fun to see. We got to see not only a trailer for season four of Rebels, but we also got to watch the entire first episode, which was kind of a cool preview experience too.
Hmm. All right,
check them out.
Well, I feel like we've covered the gamut today, but we hadn't, you know, hadn't talked in a little while. So
it's
nice to be back in the saddle.
Indeed, like Jedi cowboys,
Unitarian
Jedi cowboys.
All right. Thanks to everybody out there for being a Six Color subscriber. We appreciate it. It's like being a Unitarian space cowboy. Kinda.
Kind of, sure.
All right. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.